Little Fleetwood Mac. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Seems like a good way to get into the program today, although I think that song is actually about a breakup. But Christine Whalen, our guest today, we're going to talk about New Year's resolutions. You know, it's one thing to set them. It's another thing to stick to them. And it's another to find your purpose in life and take your steps toward achieving those purposes. And that's something we're going to talk about, too, with Christine Whalen, a fellow at back with us after a long, you know, 7 or 8 years, I think, the last time, Christine, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you. She is UW-Madison's Center, a fellow at UW-Madison's Center for Healthy Minds, and the Purpose Professor at the Emory University's College of Arts and Sciences in Atlanta, Georgia. And she's the author of 5 books, I believe. The one that comes immediately to mind is The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. And as we talk with Christine, I hope you'll join in today. How are you doing with your New Year's resolutions? Have you thought about purpose? I think most of us do at some point, typically as we get a little older, and sometimes, I think. Sometimes when we're just young and just getting started, there's a big middle part there where we may lose it. I don't know. I'm going to ask her about it. You can join in with your thoughts. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Christine, it's good to see you again.
It's great to be here.
Well, resolution. Let's start with resolutions. Mm-hmm. Here we are near the end of January. Many of us have made New Year's resolutions, made them a few weeks ago. Why do we do it?
Well, resolutions are sort of a hopeful idea for the future, right?
Yep.
We could all use to be a little better in our lives.
Yep.
And when we make a resolution, we're saying, gosh, we hope that we can achieve a better version of ourselves. But, of course, life gets in the way.
Yeah.
And our best laid plans often don't work. And part of the reason why they often don't work is because we are so hopeful about being better versions of ourselves that we end up being too hopeful. We, instead of setting 1 or 2 New Year's resolutions, we set 10 or 20 New Year's resolutions. And we fall by the wayside because we try to change too many things at once. So when we try to change too many things, often we just can't do it, and then we give up on all of them.
So, the most common ones, lose weight, I think, is one.
Lose weight, exercise more, eat better, get more sleep, stop drinking, all of those things. And we tend to give up on all of those about, 10, 15 days into the new year. So if you are one of the many people who has stopped going to the gym, started eating snacks again, stopped your abstinence or dry January, you are not alone. Now, this is not to say that all of those aren't wonderful things to try to do. It's just that you might not try to do all of them all at once. And you also might want to ask yourself the larger question of why. So why is it that you want to lose weight? Why is it that you want to go to the gym? And if it is because you feel like you should or because somebody else wants you to, then you are actually much less likely to do those things and to follow through than if it comes from an underlying value or something that you want to do for yourself. It turns out that when you actually want to do something, you're far more likely to do it. And I know that sounds so obvious, and yet lots of time, we try to make ourselves do a whole lot of things that we actually don't want to do, and then we don't actually do it.
I was thinking about my own resolutions. One I make every year is to map my run goal. Mm-hmm. It's 1,025 kilometers for the year.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I like about it is that if I miss you know, like it was 35 below a wind chill last week, I didn't go out. I didn't do my two, three miles in the morning, which I do pretty much every morning. But I didn't worry about it because I've got that goal, and I'm sure that I'm going to reach that goal because there'll be other days when I do twice as much.
Excellent. All right. So you see it as a larger motivation. All right.
Yeah.
And so this is where personality comes in, right? So you see that as a larger motivation. So I'm a little bit different. So my husband and I decided last year, actually, and we're doing it again this year, that we're doing a sort of modified 75 hard, which is for 75 days at the beginning of the year, we've committed to all sorts of things. but one of the things we're committed to doing is a 45-minute outdoor walk. It's supposed to be outdoor, like full exercise, but for us, it's really just a walk. Every day, no matter what the weather. So when it was negative 13 below, real temperature, negative 35 wind chill, we still went out for 45-minute walk. It did require Vaseline on our faces because, you know, we didn't want to get frostbite. But we did it for 45 minutes because we had committed to it. And we have pictures to prove it because, you know... street cred, right? And we did it, and that was great. And so that was one of those resolutions that actually encouraged us to meet our goals because we were doing it together. And but you know what? Here's the secret. It's because we love to walk.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do it. We weren't doing it because someone else wanted us to do it or because we thought we should. We actually really want to do it. And so we made the commitment to encourage us to do something that we wanted to do already.
Yeah, and I like to go, you know, I get up at 20 to 6 in the morning, and I go out every morning.
Exactly, and you're going to want to do a little extra on those other days to meet your goal.
Oh, yeah.
See, so it's kind of a personality thing, whether which way you want to do it. But either way, we're both doing something that we want to do, so we'll achieve our goal.
And I can't, it's not cheating really, but I know that I play golf, so I know, and I walk.
Mm-hmm. You're
so
going to get it in there.
6 mile walk every time I go out. So there you go.
There you go.
It doesn't take long to build up those kilometers, those miles when you're doing things that you enjoy.
Exactly. That, to me, is really the key. And so often when we, quote unquote, fail on our resolutions, it's because we're kind of beating ourselves up into trying to do something that are actually other people's goals for us. And, you know, so much of life is like that. And, you know, this is a very simple thing. And when I teach it to my students, they often kind of look at me like I'm Captain Obvious. Obviously, you are going to be more likely to do things you want to do. And yet so much of our lives are spent trying to get ourselves to do these things that other people tell us we should want to do.
And that's probably the problem with resolutions, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It really is. So think about the things that you both want to do and are good for you, and try to match those things together, and you're much more likely to have a successful New Year's resolution. And by the way, if your first New Year's resolutions didn't work so well for you, Lunar New Year is coming up. I always think of this
Wednesday.
As a second shot on goal, folks. This is your next attempt at having some successful resolutions. I really love this about the way our resolution system is set up. So you have another chance to make resolutions that can really stick.
So let's say we didn't make it on the New Year's, the new one.
Mm-hmm.
What about come March? Is there any reason why we can't...
can't start again in March? No, of course not. I think pick any day. Pick a Monday. Pick March 1st. Pick whatever day works for you. One of the things that I would imagine most people have had this experience in their lives, when you make a decision, it's like something sort of changes inside of you and you say, I am going to make this change in my life. It's as if the change has already happened. The shift happens in you. Have you ever had that experience?
Yeah. Yes.
That's because there are stages of behavior change. And a lot of the behavior change actually happens in what researchers would call the pre-contemplation stage of behavior change, where you're actually thinking about it. You're thinking about what it's going to take. Then there is that stage where you are going to take action. You're going to do something, and then you've got to make sure that the action sticks over a period of time. Sometimes you'll backslide a little bit, and then you've got to keep the behavior change going. You've got to sort of keep it in place and maintain it. But we discount that pre-contemplation phase where it looks like you're doing nothing, but you're actually really thinking about it. And then once that decision is made, the change can happen.
Actually, that's what happened with me many years ago when I learned about Map My Run. Mm. It was 8 years ago, 9 years ago. And I thought about that. Could I really do that? I really would like to do that. I want to do that. And then I did it. And so, 8 years, that's probably about 10,000 kilometers more than I would have done had I not started.
And that feels good, doesn't it?
Now that I think about it, that's the first I've really thought about it that way.
So this is the power. So for all of those folks listening out there who think, gosh, I haven't done anything, you may be in the pre-contemplation phase of your behavior change. And you may be in the contemplation phase where you're thinking about making that change. You're thinking about it. You're getting ready. And then when you make the decision, boom.
Yeah, there you go.
It's as good as done.
Christine Whalen, our guest today, clinical professor in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's authored 5 books. And the one that I'm thinking of, The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life, was published in 2016, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she teaches classes on happiness and well-being and is also the founding director of Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. So it's great to have her with us. Questions, comments, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Miller for WPR News. Talking about resolutions, and we're zeroing in on happiness and finding purpose in your life with our guest. And I kind of gave you the wrong title for her just about 2 minutes ago, so let me retell you what her title is. She's a fellow at UW-Madison Center for Healthy Minds and the Purpose Professor at Emory University's College of Arts and Sciences in Atlanta, Georgia. So it's great to have Christine back with us. She was first here in 2017, and now she's back. And you know, Christine, you are known as the happiness professor. How did you get that label?
I am so fortunate. I have these 2 titles. I am the happiness professor and the purpose professor. No pressure, right?
No pressure.
So I was known as the happiness professor because for 10 years, I taught a class at UW-Madison called Consuming Happiness, about how we try to buy happiness successfully and unsuccessfully in the market economy. And my students dubbed me the happiness professor. But there was a little bit of a catch, because happiness is one of my least favorite words.
It is.
Because what does it actually mean? You know, everybody has a different definition for happiness. You can define happiness as joy, or you can define happiness as pleasure. You can define happiness as satisfaction, or you can define happiness as, as friendship and family, as good times, as the hedonic or as the eudaimonic. It's kind of like it's a catch-all phrase for so many different feelings. And so when I would teach, I would ask my students to give me a synonym for happiness, and there would be all sorts, and all would be correct. So the challenge here, of course, is if you're going to try to use your limited resources of time and money to try to go get happiness, but we define it in all sorts of different ways, then actually do that. And so one of the things that I would suggest to everybody is really, rather than going after happiness, really what we're looking for is a life of purpose and meaning. We're looking for a life of thriving. And happiness is actually the byproduct of a life of thriving and a life of purpose and a life of meaning. So the idea is that when you live out your values, when you live out a life that matters to you, well, then you are living a life that makes you happy. But if you are actually just seeking a life of happiness and pleasure and satisfaction, then you may not actually find it. But if you are seeking to use your gifts in keeping with your values to make others happy, to build something that matters to you, well, then happiness may find you along the way.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about the TV series Landman. I don't know if you've watched it.
No, I haven't. Is it new? Is it old?
It's a new series, and it's about really explores how different family experiences shape the lives of its characters, and it's in oil country.
Okay.
And so it's very interesting. And when you were talking about that, immediately what popped into my mind was Jerry Jones, who's the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. And there's one really, they had him come on the show and play himself. And he's talking to one of the characters who's in the hospital, laying there with a bad heart condition. But he talks about the time spent with his family, how he started his business so that he could be with his children. And then he got his children involved in all parts of his business. And so he says, I did it for, I thought I was doing it for my children, but it was really for myself. And this apparently was he was told to do this off the cuff. And he just gives the most striking summary of maybe a purposeful life.
Oh, that's beautiful. I'll watch that.
Yeah, watch the whole thing. There are if you go online and type in Jerry Jones, you'll see some versions that are like shortened up a minute or two. But he talks for about 3 minutes just off the top of his head about his life. And I think it's what he's saying is what you were just talking about.
How wonderful. Yeah.
It was an actual. It was really from his own heart, and I thought Jerry Jones.
Who would have thought? Yeah.
who would have thought? So you have to look that up, and you might even that'd be one. If you're teaching another class, that might be one you would want to do. Why is it so difficult for people to find happiness or maybe purpose?
Well, there's a wonderful story of a teacher who wanted to kind of illustrate this for her students. And the way she did it was she gathered a bunch of her elementary school students. She handed them each a balloon and a Sharpie marker and said, "All right, kids, write your name on a balloon." So they all did. And she said, "Now we're going to go into the hallway." And she had them throw all of their balloons into the hallway. So you can imagine a bunch of little kids, all sorts of balloons, all mixed up down the hallway. And she said, "All right, now you have 30 seconds. Go find your balloon." So all these little kids go running down the hallway, elbowing each other out of the way, frantically trying to find their balloons. After 30 seconds, nobody can find their balloons. She says, "Okay, fine, stop. Now, everybody grab the balloon closest to you." And so they all do. And she says, "Now you have 30 seconds. Go give the balloon to the person whose name is on it. You have 30 seconds to do so." And in less than 30 seconds, everyone had their balloon back.
Oh, my goodness.
And the teacher says, now, these balloons are like your happiness. If you're only looking for your own, you'll never find it. But if you give this your happiness, give happiness to somebody else, then not only will you help them find theirs, but you will get yours in return. And so what this teacher was trying to teach her students was a lesson of pro-social behavior. And pro-social behavior is about sharing with others. It's about giving of yourself, but not only in a totally selfless way. And this is what I think is a really important thing to know, is that when you are acting in community with others, it's not always about being totally selfless. It's about giving of yourself and getting in return. And so when I talk about happiness and purpose, I do talk about being in community with others and sharing. But there's quite a bit of sort of, you know, smart selfishness involved in this as well. And so I encourage people to think about happiness and purpose as the idea of a sort of a give and a take, and and using your gifts, what you're good at, in keeping with your values, what you care about most, to make a positive impact on not only yourself, but on the world around you, on the people, on the causes, on the communities that you care about most.
Boy, Joanne in Appleton emailed to say that Joanne recently completed an online course that dealt with behavior that makes people happier, and wonders if doing that is made more difficult while we're making daily compromises on our own goals.
Yes. So that is an excellent, excellent point. So one of the sort of core tensions in our individual lives, in our world, is the tension between individualism and community, between me and we. So if you are all about me, 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 then yes, you will accomplish your own goals, but only up to a certain point, because if you're an island unto yourself, you can only accomplish so much, right? You do need a team. You do need others to accomplish more than a certain thing. If you are always focused on the we and giving of yourself and only paying attention to other people, then you never accomplish any of your own goals, because you're always accomplishing other people's goals and you're always selfless. And that's not great either. So the balance is when to focus on your own stuff, when to give of yourself to others. We see this in our own lives, we see this in our family lives, but by the way, we also see this in our nation. We see this in our government. This is the fight between states' rights and federal rights, yeah. Right? I mean, we see this worldwide between nations and global citizenship as well. So how do we find the right balance? It's something that we all have to continually negotiate. And it's a worthy balance to try to negotiate. It can't be one or the other.
Will in Seymour has something that may relate to what we were just talking about here. Will, thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So listening to your program today, a lot of the things that I'm hearing, it sounds like a dead ringer for some of the ideas in the principles of motivational interviewing is what it's called. And I had been exposed to this through a course that was actually, it originated in our state's National Guard for the soldiers and airmen there.
Yeah.
as a way to equip leaders with tools to help build that motivation for their servicemen. And one of the main ideas was that to really make that lasting change, you need that motivation to come from within, have intrinsic motivation. So the way that the principles of it were, you had engaging, so you get to know a person, you have evoking, so you're building the emotions for getting that change, imagining yourself making a positive change. That'd be third. You have focusing, you're finding things that you need to change, and then all the way at the end is planning. And I think a lot of people want to make a plan first without really having an emotional connection to the change that they're trying to make. And without having, you know, without your soul really being into it, without having that enthusiasm for it, you're usually pretty destined to fail. So it's, I'm glad to hear more focus on this and stuff. And it seems like it's growing in popularity over time throughout the world here.
Well, Will, thank you so much for calling. Christine, comments here.
Absolutely. Oh, Will, that is such a fantastic feedback, and I'm thrilled to hear that this is being used everywhere. This is so wonderful. You know, the way I phrase it is the importance of asking why it matters before how to make it happen. And so why is the purpose and how are the goals? Right? So you ask why it matters. So what is the purpose of any change that you're going to make in your life? And then the goals are really the step-by-step of how to put it into action. And as you said, all too often, we jump into the goals. We jump into the what do I need to do? What do I need to change? And we often, I hate even to say that we often fail, because it's really almost not even a failure. We often just don't follow through on our goals because they don't matter to us. We haven't figured out why they matter, and they actually may not matter to us, so we don't follow through. And yet then we blame ourselves as if we have failed when we just didn't do them because they don't matter.
Will, thank you again for calling. Christine Whalen, our guest today, as we talk with her about resolutions, about goals, about purpose, finding purpose. You can join in, too. I hope you have a question or comment. The number is 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Vivian emailed, how much should we rely on family members or friends to help us, or should we be prepared to go it alone?
It's wonderful to get feedback from other people, as long as you understand that everybody comes with their own perspective. So the people who know us the best certainly can offer really useful advice. They also will come with a sense of who they want us to be, where we fit into their system. And so you want it to, I'm being very delicate here, right? You want to take everything with a grain of salt, right? And so if it's helpful advice, take it. If it's advice that doesn't feel right for you at the time, thank them for it and hold it loosely. I would also very much recommend gathering all of the advice of a variety of different people, and then seeing whether the advice clusters around a particular point, because then, you know, if you have three people who are saying all the same thing, even if you don't like it, it's worth listening to.
You know, there was the 2024 World Happiness Report.
Mm-hmm.
Young Americans ranked 62nd happiest compared with people in 142 other countries.
Yeah.
Why is that?
As with all things, it's complicated. So the first thing is the way that that these reports are measured. So they use what's called a Cantrell ladder to measure the happiness of various nations. And so what they're asking is a comparative happiness to other people. So they ask you to imagine a ladder where there are various rungs, and you can which rung do you imagine yourself on? So this automatically creates a visual that somebody is above you and somebody is below you. So given that visual, you then have to say, do you think that you are on the top of the ladder, or are you one rung down, meaning that there are people who are above you and such? depending on the culture that you are in, it is going to be more or less socially acceptable for you to think that you are at the top or the bottom of the ladder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so already we have a little bit of, we have a lot of socialization attached to this ranking. So that's one part of that we have to think about when we think about this ranking. The other thing to think about is that young people right now have a lot of media attention around the fact that they are on their phones all the time, and that's making them unhappy, right? So with all that said, I do think young people in America are increasingly isolated because they are on their phones and not around people as much. So yes, perhaps they are more more socially isolated and less happy. All this one the reason I'm a little hesitant to sort of have a grand answer on this.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm much more hesitant even in answering this question than I was when this data first came out, is because in the last month or two, a series of articles have come out challenging research articles have come out challenging the loneliness epidemic in the United States, and whether the data on the loneliness epidemic is really true. Because methodologically, it's a very hard thing to measure.
Yeah.
So right now, academics are kind of wondering whether we are in fact as lonely and unhappy as the data is, that the data of the last 5 or 10 years has shown that we are. And basically saying every generation we worry that the young people are lonelier and more unhappy than they have been, and that the good old days everyone was less lonely and less unhappy, you know, than they are now. So just to take all of this with a little bit of a grain of salt, and to make sure that we are not overstating things, I would say that that we should watch it, but happiness is a subjective measure. The more you try to grasp for happiness, the less happy we are. The more we look inward, and the more solipsistic and self-focused we become, the less happy we become. And so any measures that are increasingly focused on our happiness will increasingly show that we are less happy. So the fact that we as a nation, that we as a world, have begun to focus more and more on happiness and well-being, it's not surprising that those measures are showing we're becoming less happy.
Diane in Portage has something for us.
Let's go. Good.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What's on your
Hello.
Mind?
I have a question. I've wondered for a long time about altruism. If you do something out of doing it for someone else, so your intention is altruistic, but you receive rewards for it, is it still altruism?
It is indeed. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. In fact, it is so selfish altruism is still altruism, and in fact, it is in fact called sort of like sort of intelligent altruism, and so that is altruism that is to be encouraged. Just because you get benefit from it does not mean that it is not altruistic. So good for you for doing good things for others, even if you get benefit from it yourself. So that is you do not have to just sacrifice. Yes, I think it would be complete self-sacrifice if you did not get any benefit yourself.
Diane,
go forth and do good for others and get good for yourself.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I think everybody needs to do a little bit more of that, and they would feel much better about themselves.
I agree. I agree, Diane.
Diane, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man, that was good. you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for listening in today on WPR News. Just a quick mention, at noon, we talked to the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin will talk about research showing winters and changing storm systems on the Great Lakes. And of course, as always, they will answer your weather questions and probably take a look at your weather photos, because we usually get a bunch of those as well as we move along. That's at noon today. But right now, we're talking about resolutions, goals, purpose-driven life with our guest, Christine Whalen, a fellow at UW-Madison Center for Healthy Minds, and the Purpose Professor at the Emory University's College of Arts and Sciences in Atlanta, Georgia. Great to have her with us. One of her books, The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. Questions, I hope you'll join in, or comments, or maybe an experience to share. The number's 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's take a call from Kim in Arena. Kim, thank you for calling.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
What's on your mind?
I just wanted to offer something. When we were talking about synonyms for happiness, instantly, and mine's two words, but it's inner peace. And I'm 67, and I've been in the corporate world, and my husband and I now live on the Wisconsin River, in what was never meant to be a year-round cabin. So we have critters. We have too much iron in our water. And some of my very well-meaning friends say, how can you live like this? And that really bothered me for a couple of weeks. And I'm like, but I'm happy. I've never been happier. So, you know, I've been around the block. I'm 67, and I've been in the corporate world, and I was very happy there, but I've really never been happier than where we are now. And I guess it's just the happiness is in the eye of the beholder.
Thank you for sharing that. That's so beautiful, because it's inner peace, but it's also self-knowledge. Because what you have just described is that you know that you are at a place in life where this is what you want. And that's actually why I dislike the word happiness, because it's not a one-size-fits-all word. It really is about self-knowledge and a self-definition of, as Farrell says in that song, what happiness means to you, right? So you have defined happiness in this way of inner peace and tranquility and self-knowledge of what it means at this point in your life, and it means for you to be right where you belong right now. And so that's wonderful. I'm so glad. I'm so happy for you. Enjoy every minute of it. You've earned it. And enjoy those critters. Enjoy the peace. Go for it.
Actually, back to that happiness report, it did show that older Americans ranked 10th happiest. So relative to the young folks who were 62nd, I mean, does that really, and, you know, given the things that you mentioned about the scale, it is interesting, because these are Americans, U.S. people, young versus old. So looking at it that way and wondering, maybe there are more people like Kim. And that's the reason. Why are older Americans happier than younger Americans?
There also may be less social stigma for older Americans to say they feel like they are higher up on that ladder. Or there may be, in fact, more social encouragement for older Americans to say they are higher up on that ladder. I mean, it's a very yeah, complicated thing about where we feel that we should put ourselves on that ladder. So these questions are complicated for a whole variety of reasons. I would like to say that there are more people like Kim. I mean, it would be mm-hmm. wonderful if there are more people like that. I'm not sure that's true, but it would be great to know that it would be great to think that there are more people who have worked hard, who have earned some time to enjoy cabins and some peace and tranquility.
And I'm glad she has a radio, too.
I'm absolutely.
And a phone.
That's right.
Thanks again, Kim. Diane in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I just recently listened to a gentleman, and he was talking about that we cannot create our own happiness, that it's this vicious doom gloom cycle that we get ourselves into. And to help us learn how to become happy with ourselves and content is to look at what breaks our heart, asking ourselves, well, what breaks my heart? What causes me to be upset? And then taking action on that, and that can be your purpose. And I have a couple things that have broken my heart, and I either put my finances towards that and my volunteer, my time. But I thought that was really insightful.
Interesting. So the other way to frame that is, so that really comes around the idea of what are the ideas and causes toward which you feel like you can have the most impact and that really speak to your core values. So saying it in terms of breaking your heart says it in the negative, but you could also think of it in terms of the positive, the about which you care most, about which you are most passionate. There's sort of a saying that passion, you can take the word apart, and it's about pass the I on. But the I in passion is the lowercase I. It's not about me, but it's about passing your gift on. It's about passing the I, the thing that you care about most, on. And so the idea of giving of yourself and your values. So yes, you can think about it in terms of breaking your heart in terms of the negative, or you can think of it in terms of breaking your heart open in terms of the positive, in terms of what you care about most. So either way, that idea of putting your limited resources, and we all have limited resources, whether it's limited resources of money, of energy, of time, and spending those limited resources in keeping with your values to make a positive impact, absolutely, that's a great way of thinking about how to live your purpose and, by transition there, find happiness.
Diane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You know, I was thinking about you. You have written a bunch of books, a very popular book, The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. You came out in 2021. You released a series of 10 lectures on the subject of finding your purpose. I'm wondering how has helping other people find their purpose become your purpose?
Teaching is my professional purpose. Translating academic research into small steps programs that people can use in their everyday life is my professional purpose. It also is somewhat of my personal purpose because I have 5 kids, ages 9 through 16. And so as a teacher, I'm also a teacher as a mom. And so I spend a whole lot of my time organizing, teaching, mentoring in my personal and professional life. So, yeah, that's my purpose. My purpose is teaching, is translating, is organizing. And I live it at home. I live it at work.
Yeah. And you do talk about a purpose gap, too.
There's often a
purpose gap. And what do you mean by that?
So in the corporate world, there is a huge purpose gap. There's a statistic that was put out by McKinsey a couple years ago that found that 90% of executives, people in the C-suite, say that they have a sense of purpose in their work. 90%. But only 10% of folks working on the front lines, working as either in the factories or working in the front line of a retail store, only 10% of those employees feel like their work is purposeful. So that is a huge gap, 10% versus 90%. And that huge purpose gap, I believe we can bridge that purpose gap if we begin to talk about purpose as a verb. If we talk about purpose not as a statement that hangs in a corporate boardroom, but as something that we can do every day when we use our gifts in keeping with our values, when we actually think of purpose as small steps that we can take in our work, not just as a noun, but as a verb. And when we actually start talking to frontline workers about purpose and stop only talking to corporate executives about purpose.
Yeah, I can see where the execs are the global view of what their work is about, whereas the person on the front line, all I do is make this little cog in this widget.
Yeah, that's purposeful work too.
I know, but they don't. But they may not view it that way.
Right, but I think the reason they don't view it that way is because we've never talked about it that way. You know, when we think about how anything is built, it's built brick by brick.
Yeah.
How are our lives built? How is a wall built? How is anything built? It's built one step at a time. And if we think about a resolution, if we think about anything we do in our life, it's got to be small steps to achieve big results. And I believe purpose is very much the same. And so my passion right now, my purpose in this purpose work, is to help people see the small steps that build a life of purpose. So I'm really excited about this work because I think it can have a big impact in everybody's everyday life. And it can give people a sense of agency and credit for all the purposeful work they're already doing. So rather than another thing that we have to do, it's giving you credit for the purposeful work you do every day, Larry, on this show. So you can go to bed saying, I've done something really purposeful today. Not just, I did another day, but I've done purposeful work today.
Yeah. And I do feel that when I go to bed at night. I think about what the day was like and talking with great guests and hopefully and thinking, yeah, I think we did pretty good today.
You made a difference.
So, and you recommend a daily purpose exercise even.
I do.
Mean, is that the exercise, thinking about it? Or what?
So on my website, on ChristineWhelan.com, people can download either a free digital one. You can access a free digital daily purpose statement or a PDF where you can print it out. And it breaks it down into step-by-step exercises. I have like a Mad Libs purpose statement exercise you can do on a daily basis. And the idea is that if you break a daunting idea of a purpose statement into a small steps exercise, you can turn it into a pleasurable exploration of possibilities.
I like the sound of that. Oh, my gosh. Well, you like your work.
I really do. I am passionate about purpose.
And you seem happy, too.
I've got a lot for which to be grateful and a lot of things to be happy about.
Well, Karen and Madison emailed to say that your enthusiasm is carried on the radio, which is another medium for sharing your message. And Karen is very appreciative of your presence here. And so am I.
Well, thank you.
I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today, Christine. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And hopefully we can, it was been 8 years or whatever.
Let's do it again before another 8 years.
Yeah.
How's that?
Oh, yeah. We got to do it more quickly, sooner than that. Christine, thanks again.
Thank you.
Christine Whalen, our guest today, fellow at the UW-Madison Center for Healthy Minds and the Purpose Professor at Emory University's College of Arts and Sciences in Atlanta, Georgia. And the one book that I kept mentioning that you might want to take a look at, The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. And what's your website?
ChristineWhelan.com.
ChristineWhelan.com. Coming up, we're going to take a look at weather and weather conditions with our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time for another visit from our weather guys as we talk. We'll talk a little bit about Great Lakes weather and the, you know, the whole Great Lakes region. We'll zero in on Wisconsin certainly too, and we'll answer your weather questions. And maybe you, if you've got a weather photo you want to send us, we've got a screen set up here in the studio, and we can handle that. With us today, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman back once again, former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW and also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you back.
Good to be back.
And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call with your weather or climate question, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@wpr.org. And, of course, send an email in, a photo as well, to talk@wpr.org. Love to have that as well. Your first time back on the show since the start of 2025. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the year that was for a minute or two anyway. The two of you write a weekly column, and in your column you recently answered the question, was 2024 an interesting weather year for Wisconsin?
I'll say every year is interesting, yeah. But 2024 in particular, I think it was the warmest year for overall warmest temperature for the state of Wisconsin. And it was one of the wettest as well, if I remember right.
Yeah, and the wet was May, June,
right.
July.
It doesn't seem that way, but there's snow on the ground now. But.
And then it didn't rain much for August and September, but it still stayed at the top.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. We had a tornado in February.
Yeah.
First time we've ever had a tornado in February. I mean, it's got only 28 days usually, but you would still expect that we would have had one at some point, because we have had them in January and March.
Yeah, and thunderstorms in February are not that unusual. They're perhaps as unusual as any month in the year, I guess I would say that from my experience, but they're not so unusual that you say, oh my God, I heard a rumble of thunder in February. This never happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often, but it happens.
And we had thundersnow too, right? Wasn't that in December?
Or somebody reported. I didn't see it, so I think I'm recalling now the frustration of not having seen it.
Yeah,
so I think so, yeah.
And here probably the big, certainly the biggest weather story is out in Southern California with no...
Yeah.
The raging fires.
Yeah, the
raging
fires.
Because of the lack of rain.
Yeah.
When you look at precipitation maps of California, you can see Southern California is just dry.
Yeah.
Northern isn't as much.
That's right. And, you know, the background condition that leads to the Santa Ana type winds, the offshore winds that are going to dry because they're coming down the side of the mountains anyway, that's climatological. It may be bigger or stronger or weaker in one year or the other, but that's not the factor, as you're pointing out. It's the lack of rain, and that accumulates, integrates over the whole season and leaves the fuel just ready to go.
Yeah. And now I guess there's big storms coming for parts of Southern California, so now the big worry is mudslides.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. You get a lot of precipitation. There's no vegetation there to hold the soil in, and you've got sloping terrain. It's not a good situation.
They're a great example of things coming in twos because they're directly related to each other. Yeah.
We get some wildfires in Wisconsin, but they're different from those.
Yeah, they're different in a lot of ways. I mean, one of the things, that the follow-up mudslides are less common here because we don't have the orography that they have in Southern California. So there's not trees aren't growing on the sides of really steep hills. Also, you know, Peshtigo Fire was a result of an extraordinarily dry summer, and so it happens. And at the same time of year in some cases, like it did then. But it's not as common here. I think we're just a little bit more protected from the long-standing sort of droughts. And maybe it's even the ecology of the trees. I don't know that, but I wonder if there's not something about the forests here that are a little different.
Yeah, I think some of the forests, Larry probably knows more than us about the sustainability of some forests, of some trees during fires. In fact, some require fires in order to seed themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Peshtigo Fire, I forgot about that thing.
Yeah.
And that was a really nasty.
The worst fire disaster in the United States ever.
Up till this year.
Well, maybe, That's a good point.
I think more lives were lost in Peshtigo, though.
Yes. TJ at Amherst has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, TJ. PJ, are you there?
I am.
Oh, okay. What's on your mind?
Well, warmer winters are changing things. And I was over at a neighbor's house helping him the other day. He's got a gray water system for his washing machine. And it goes way out in the backyard and into a big pile of rocks. And for the first time ever, that line froze. So is this going to be a problem again and again and again?
It might be. My guess is that it froze because there's no snow.
Yeah.
And so the snow provides an insulation so that the frost depth doesn't get as deep and as cold.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting because it really makes the soil colder and the frost line go deeper. And while we've had some really cold temperatures, if we would have had snow on the ground,
we
would have had really cold air temperatures.
I think last Tuesday or Wednesday morning, whenever it was minus 13, I think it was Tuesday, it would have been close to minus 25 or so with a regular snow cover. And if it had been a fresh snow cover of, you know, a foot or more, it would have been even colder than that probably. That's a really good point, Steve. And it points out how contradictory sometimes the accurate and basic explanations for some of these weird things can be. You might say, wait a minute, the winters are getting warmer, how can my pipes freeze or a line freezes? It's because there's no snow, which you usually can count on in the winter to insulate the ground. It's a great explanation.
My
and brother, who lives in North Carolina, they also had a real cold blast, and when he saw how cold we were, you know, he texted me and called me and just said, are you let you you know, your water drip out of your forest faucet, which I didn't because I haven't done that in many, many years.
Yeah.
But it got me thinking
what's
going on.
I know. Jeepers.
Well, yeah, and I was going to bring something up about that, and then it just flew out of my head. So instead of that, it'll come back. It'll come back. And in the meantime, TJ, thanks a lot. Let's go to Dot in Manitowoc. Hi, Dot.
Many years ago, the rules were the core of winter was January 15th to February 15th. Obviously, Mother Nature does not read the Farmer's Almanac. Has that all changed?
Well, before John says anything, I'll jump in. Nobody should read the Farmer's Almanac for forecasts. Having said that,
I suspect the almanac has not changed, but it's not an authority. But I think that's a really good rule of thumb that you just pointed out. That's about the month after the solstice, and that is about the time when you get as cold as we're going to be. Right now, to get more precise, we're in the week of the climatologically coldest week of the year. But I don't think we're going to realize it this particular winter in southern Wisconsin, maybe the whole state. It's just been an unusually warm winter, despite last week's cold. We're still running fifth warmest ever in the northern hemisphere and barely unseated from number two in the last 77 years. So we got plenty of time yet to still make that up. We may become the warmest or the second warmest ever. But even with our cold spell locally, not even close to a regular winter.
And I checked the 5-day forecast, and I think it's where Madison, for example, is set to be 50 degrees. Wednesday or Thursday, I forgot now. But
and I think as we warm up, I still think that our annual minimum temperatures is going to be this time of year.
Yeah, that's right.
It's still
going
to stay that way. It's just going to be warmer.
Yeah, you know? And you know your point about the lack of snow, which can be variable from one year to the next, that is going to have a bigger impact, I think, on exactly what the minimum temperature is for a given cold season now. Because if you don't have snow on the ground, with that kind of cold air mass that we had, it could have been easily minus 30 and minus 13. Not piddly, but comparatively, small stakes.
And the point I was going to mention earlier was that when the frost depth, when you've got frost depth like that, and then if you get snows in the spring, then there's a lot of flooding.
Because when the snow melts, the ground is still frozen.
Yeah. The ground is still frozen. Carol in Middleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Oh, this couldn't be more timely. I'm so appreciative. My husband and I want to fly out to Richmond, Virginia this coming Friday to pick up a puppy that's going to be too big, because he's too old, to bring home on the plane. So we're renting a car and driving him home. And so it's very much weather dependent. And I checked the route on the way back. I checked about six places. It looks like there might be some light rain. I don't see anything that says don't do this. And I know it's always, you know, you take some chances, but is there any site I can check or can you check or to make sure nothing, you know, unexpected
is happening? What's a good site for Carol to be checking? Now she's got a long range.
Yeah, she's got a long range.
Yeah, and you're thinking about a two-day drive, Carol. Is that about right?
It's going to be 7 hours Saturday and then another seven on Sunday.
If you go to the nws.gov, they will probably, you'll land on the National Weather Service page, not a local office like Milwaukee or a place like that. So if you land on the nws.gov national page, one of the first things you see is a map with hazards on it. And if you can see on your route from Richmond back to Madison that there's no snow, there's no ice as a hazard, you can be pretty assured that you're not going to have to worry about it. Now, of course, if you look today, it won't give you a forecast for the days in which you're going to drive, and you wouldn't have great confidence in them if they're a week away. But if you're, you know, when you're just about to leave Madison to Richmond, take a look at that. That would be something that would set your mind at ease, I think.
NWS.gov.
I think it's NWS.gov. And if I'm wrong, it'll probably Google smart enough to say, you didn't mean that. You meant NOAA.NWS.gov. But whatever it is, I usually put NWS Milwaukee, MKE. So NWS space MKE. And even from there, you can get to the national page.
And then the other thing I'd look at is road condition maps. You know, each state must have one. I know Wisconsin has one, and they talk about the road conditions. Mm. So if you're in one of those warning areas, that might be a good thing to check as well, see if there's snow on their highways or not.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go, Carol. Thanks very much. What's the turnpike that goes out east?
90?
I was trying to remember the turnpike because I was talking with a climate guy once, or a weather guy once, and he said, you know, if they'd have built that turnpike about 10 miles south of where
no lake effect snow.
Right. Yeah. They'd have gotten rid of the lake effect snow, and they would have millions of dollars in damage from crashes, and that would have been avoided.
Boy, we used to drive when my family lived in New York, and Ann's family still does, but in the wintertime. And yeah, boy, we got hit with that lake of snowfall around Lake Michigan a lot, and it was nasty.
Yeah, so, that's long in the tooth, though, because you've got Cleveland, Toledo, Akron, Pittsburgh. They're all Buffalo. They're all on the lakes in their big commerce center. So
I think Joel might have been trying NWS.gov and wasn't getting anything. We wondered if it's weather.gov.
Weather.gov, it might be that.
Yeah. Weather.gov. Maybe that's the one to give a try for if you don't get NWS.gov.
Yeah, sorry if I get the wrong address. I don't use the addresses anymore. It's like knowing your own phone number. Yeah, remember when you had to in the old days?
Now you dash push number one.
Yeah,
Our guys, they can't remember their phone numbers. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests today, the weather guys. Great to have them along as we talk climate and weather. And, of course, you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, with us from the UW-Madison. It's always great to have them come by to talk weather and climate. And Don in Iron River has a curious question. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Say, I attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I took a couple courses in meteorology. And how did you guys get involved
in the whole process? How have your careers progressed, essentially?
You know,
this is Steve.
Steve. I was not a weather geek. When I was an undergrad, I was actually really interested in physics. And wanting to be a physics teacher, high school physics teacher, which my dad kept telling me, if you want to be a teacher, become a university teacher. But when I got into my senior year, physics at that time was all about nuclear physics. Mm. And I just didn't like nuclear physics. I wanted to see things. Mm-hmm. And so a fellow friend and advisor suggested that I take a meteorology class, that's applied physics. And I did, and I was like, wow, this is applied physics. And I can see it. And that got me on my career path.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have overlap there. I was kind of a weather geek, but in my own way, not in the way that's kind of well advertised in our department right now. I never had an interest in forecasting the weather at all. I still don't really. But I had a morning paper route when I was a boy, and I got it in 1972, I think. And so it was just after the moon landing. And I lived in northeast New England where we got pretty good snow, especially in the 1970s. It was perfect time for me to have this job. So I was the first kid out. My dad was a public school teacher. So we'd be waiting to find out if it was school on a snow day. We'd be up before all my slacker friends, and I'd get to put the first footprints in the snow. So I felt like Neil Armstrong. And I've never, ever forgotten any of those three things. And so they still get me captivated today. I was up to say 3 a.m. today talking to European colleagues about a field program for next year. We're doing a dry run right now. And having them all talk about the things they want to investigate got me stirring again. So it's great. I can't put it down.
Oh, man. Well, Don, thank you. That gives everybody a little insight into these two characters. It was great. Thank you so much. Richard in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I was a weather observer for the National Weather Service years ago, but so I got a pretty keen eye for the sky. And I noticed a study back when 9/11 occurred, and there were no airline traffic for a few days. They say the average temperature of possibly the United States or wherever they report temperatures dropped by an average of 6 degrees with no airline traffic up in the sky because they had shut down the airline traffic. And I'll notice when I'm ice fishing out on a clear blue sky and a few planes come by and the precipitation dissipates and creates a white opaque layer in the sky, that the temperature will drop out on the ice, you know, 6 degrees right away. And I'm just thinking that our current reporting methods are even accurate considering the artificial pollutants in the air that are, you know, actually blocking the legitimate temperature down here.
So a couple of things. One is I remember that 9/11 study. They were looking at contrails because all planes were shut down. And there was a reduction, obviously, in the number of contrails. I don't remember a big change in temperature, only because, and I wouldn't think it would be that big, only because they don't cover that much of the United States territorial-wise.
I think it was fractional in the tenths of degrees, and only overnight lows were a little bit colder.
Right.
I think, because I remember you telling me that, actually.
Right.
And that was done at Whitewater, wasn't it? UW-Whitewater.
Yeah, Whitewater. There was this researcher
and
there.
So it was a fractional change, and I think it was only at night, because the radiative cooling was a little bit enhanced.
Yeah.
Right time of year for that, too.
Right.
Richard, there you go. Thank you for calling. Louise in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I was curious about the historical data on the lack of snow in Wisconsin. Is this an unusual year or, you know, atypical, or has this happened before? And then wondering about impact of drought in early spring just with lack of snow cover.
Yeah. Snow amount in a given season is among the most highly variable at a single station, one of the most highly variable quantities that I've seen in my experience as a meteorologist all these years, including here in Madison or any place in southern Wisconsin. I think there was a year in the 1930s or the 1880s, a record goes back a long way, where there was almost no snow at all for the entire cold season. So something even worse than this has happened before. I don't know how common it is. It wasn't. We wrote one of our newspaper articles about this years ago.
Yeah.
I remember grouping them into four or five different categories, and the category of really under 10 inches or under 15 inches of snow was populated, but not by many winters.
Yeah.
And so it's not entirely unprecedented, but it's very unusual to go this far into the winter without any substantial snow, which is the case for us this year. It doesn't mean we won't end up with something close to average, but it doesn't look like it the next several days, at least. We'll get into February without any substantial snow.
Yeah.
And then the springtime, as we were mentioning earlier, the circulation pattern really changes in the springtime, and we get a lot of convective storms. And I think the real danger there, as we were saying earlier, is that the ground is really frozen.
Yeah.
And if there's no snow on it, all that precipitation will just run off.
Yeah,
liquid precipitation.
And you waste that water. So even if you're rescued by a return of the storm track, if the conditions preceding it are wrong, like they seem to be this year, you can waste it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading, I was talking with Steve before the show started about a Washington Post article on how the map, weather map showing how winter is flipped upside down in the U.S. with more snow in New Orleans and Pensacola, Florida than they've had in Des Moines, Iowa, or New York. But at the end of that article, they did, the weather people there just, I think, not weather people at the Post, but who they were reporting on, said the jet stream is at a relative lull across the country, but that's not going to last. There's potential in late January and early February for another moist pulse of the subtropical jet, this time for the Rockies, Plains, and Midwest, and that could soon change as a result.
Well, we were talking today in our discussion for the field program that at least over the North Atlantic, the jet's roaring across the North Atlantic, and it's going to be an active week. We're going to have a lot of things to think about. Not so much over North America till maybe at the end of the first couple of days of February, so maybe a week or so from now, things might start to look a little different. And that might be what the Post is talking about. And they have a really good crew there. Jason Samenow, one of our graduates, runs the Capital Weather Gang, the Washington Post, and he's hired over the last 15 or so years a really good crew. So they do know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Really interesting. And your comment on the jet stream and jets, there was another article in the Post, it might have been in the, well, I know it was in the Post, about the jets going, the air, carrying people across Europe,
right,
going 850 miles an hour.
Yeah, because the tailwind is almost 200 knots right now. And it will be much of the rest of this week.
Jesus.
Sometimes happens.
So they're getting in a couple hours early.
Yeah, New York to London. You can sit on the runway as long as you want because you're going to get there on time.
Oh, man.
Just don't come the other way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No.
Louise, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And some open lines you can get on at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. John in Port Wing has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, you guys. I'm pushing 82 years old. I've been a weather geek all my life. I grew up in the outdoors hunting and fishing southern Wisconsin from my preteen years. My question is there some way that we can – is there a – available online resource to follow the climate change thing, because it's definitely here. I remember it was traditional. We hunted deer to the weekend after Thanksgiving. The next weekend we went ice fishing. We usually had snow for deer season. I grew up around La Crosse. I now live in northern Wisconsin, been up here for 22 years, a throwing distance to Lake Superior, and we can't get snow. We can't get the ground frozen so we can run our trail groomers through the marshes. When we finally get snow, there's no frost in the ground under it.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is the NOAA Climate Office, which gives a good picture of the U.S. Personally, I'm an avid follower of the Wisconsin State Climate Office.
Yeah.
They do a really good job of summarizing what's happening with our climate on a monthly basis. And looking about what that change has been. Steve and Ed are just really great work with.
And staying local is probably not a bad idea. We know there are some forces marshaling an assault against NOAA in Washington, D.C. And I guarantee you one of the things that would go first is anything that has to do with the climate. And it's dangerous and not responsible.
Yeah, it's disgraceful.
Relating kind of to the Great Lakes, John was asking about in the Lake Superior area. Glenn emailed to ask why Lake Michigan is not cooling. Glenn says he's been studying deep water temperatures in the lake, and they seem to have been increasing.
I think it depends on when you're looking at it. I mean, right now, the Great Lakes are really down in ice cover, and the water temperatures are up. And so what that means, and that's the trend that has been going on, what that means is that the overturning changes. Particularly in Lake Michigan. And so it may look colder at a certain time of the year, depending, like in, I may get this mixed up, but if it's spring is going longer, it may look warm. I'm going to be quiet. The lakeologists, people are going to call me up.
Yeah, but the point I think you're making, and I don't know the details either, but the point is that the water doesn't reside at the bottom of the lake very long in the Great Lakes, except Superior,
In Superior.
Superior has water that's sequestered for a long time, but not even Lake Michigan
does. They overturn, and that's how you get the ice form.
And back to climate change, remember, Mel had emailed to ask if WPR or UW has limited use of the phrase climate change. Perhaps they've been listening closely. Mel hasn't been listening closely, but says he haven't heard mention of the extremes we're experiencing. Well, talking about it today, I don't think...
Yeah.
I don't think for UW.
No, not for us yet. Certainly not for UW. I'm not sure what the current administration will be doing. I mean, climate change for many years was a bad word to use, according to some of the politicians. And I'll also say the Republicans in general. It's not just Trump, it's the Republicans.
Yeah.
But, you know, the evidence is so overwhelming right now, and people are beginning to see that evidence without even looking at the scientific data.
That's right.
So I'd be surprised if it gets banned. But then again, there are other words like DEI that are getting banned.
Right,
so we never really know where we're going. And again, that's not at the university. That's at the government federal level.
If you don't believe in gravity, don't let your kids climb trees. Right?
Joseph in Oxford, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have noticed, and just an observation, I'm kind of a weather geek, that it seems like it's windier than it used to be. I lived in Kansas back many years ago, and the wind blew all the time there. And it seems like over the last 5 to 10 years, it seems like the wind blows here all the time. And today is another example of it's, you know, a nice day, but the wind's kind of taking the sail, wind out of the sail, so to speak. And the fact that it's kind of ruined a nice day with too much wind. So is there any kind of data that says that it's actually increased over the last few years?
Thanks, Joseph, for calling. And I want to just throw in Chris's email as well, because it relates to this, wondering what impact climate change has had on wind velocity. Chris is a long-distance kayaker and has noticed more days this past summer with higher winds. Chris is in Door County and wondering if this is the result of greater contrast between land heating up versus colder water.
It's a standard variable that's reported at, you know, at a station like Madison First Water Station, maybe even the second water stations, every day. What's the average wind? What's the peak gust? So that data is available. And the fact that, you know, I don't patrol the data in that particular variable often, but the fact that nobody's written anything about it in the literature that says it's systematically getting windier or less windy at the surface makes me doubt that it is. So the absence of a report on that, which would be like picking an apple from a tree, it's so obvious if it were really there that I probably it's not.
It just turns out that last week I actually started looking at this question came up on a different avenue. And I went to the Wisconsin Climate Office site and started looking at it and looking for it, because I'll bet they have that data. But then I got distracted looking at other data that they have. But I'll get back to look at that, and maybe we'll do a column on that.
Yeah.
A listener emailed to ask if there's a correlation between less Arctic ice and a weaker jet stream bringing colder air to the Great Plains. In other words, are the frigid temps we're experiencing happening because of a warming planet?
There's a theory that is contested right now that suggests, well, first is an observational basis for the fact that the high latitudes are warming faster in the northern hemisphere than the lower latitudes. And that would do some damage to the pole to equator temperature gradient, where it systematically gets colder toward the pole, which fuels in turn the wind speeds at the jet stream. So the weaker that difference in temperature gets, the weaker the jet gets. That's all reasonable. And one would have that expectation, perhaps, given the observations of the warming at high latitude outpacing the warming at low latitudes. But my own work has kind of shown me that the jet has not changed its speed at all. It's just become more sinuous. And that suggests, paradoxically, that the circulation, the stirring in the hemisphere, has increased in the presence of the warming. And I don't really know how to rectify that right now. I'm confused by it. So I don't know that there's really a definitive answer on this question. I have a feeling it's still going to have to be worked out in the next couple of decades.
That's really interesting because, as you're saying, it gets more sinusoidal. You think of that as more mixing.
Right, yeah.
And if it's warm or temperature gradient is less, you wouldn't expect that you would need that.
Why would you need it? Right. Yeah. It's very paradoxical.
Yeah.
And I suspect, you know, it might have something to do with what's going on in the overlying stratosphere, because things are a little different in the stratosphere during the warming. And so maybe there's a battle going on that manifests itself in this increased stirring in the troposphere, if it's true. Well, I know it's true from the observations. I just don't know how to explain
why. Yeah.
I can't explain it yet.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, with us today. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys today on the show, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW-Madison. John's former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, of course, emeritus professor in the department. So great to have them along. And again, join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Jill sent us a lovely photo of a sunset. It's really golden.
It's lovely. We've been talking about this since it's been posted the last couple of minutes. It is so golden. What surprises me, though, is that the clouds that are associated, the low-level clouds, aren't lit up. And maybe that was the case, you know, a few minutes before the picture was taken. A lot of times at sunset, when you have low-level clouds, they turn pink and violet and things like that. And we're not getting here, which makes the yellow where the sun is really intense, which is really cool.
Maybe it's just about to happen because it looks like if there's a cloud edge through those trees that the sun has just come through, you know, and it's headed down, it might get pink and orange, pink and red next.
Really soon, yeah. In fact, you can sort of see pinkish in some of
that. Yeah, that one
beautiful,
tree.
It's a beautiful photo.
It is.
Yeah, for sure. Jerry in Kokana, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, with the warmer temperatures, I understand that we get heavier rainstorms than anything. Anything we can predict for northeastern Wisconsin that you guys know of?
Northeastern. What's coming to my mind is, you got a lot of water bodies up there, and the Great Lakes are having less ice on them. And some of the researchers have been showing is, and we already knew this in different ways, it's just changing, is that as that water, cold air flows over those warm bodies, you get a lot of snowfall downwind of the lakes. And so I could imagine that getting more snow in the area.
With the right wind direction.
With the right wind direction.
So sometimes you get a whole winter when you don't get that wind direction. I think we're in one right now. It's kind of weird, but that's one thing. Yeah, And also, perhaps the summertime convection, like over the Keweenaw Peninsula, that's mountainous at its spine. You know, you have Superior and Michigan adjacent, and when it warms up over land, it produces a little bit of surface convergence. So maybe there'll be increased precipitation in that location in the summertime, and maybe it's already begun to occur. I don't know.
The Great Lakes, according to a new study, shows that the Great Lakes have lost an average of 14 days of winter per decade since 1995.
What's the definition of the
30
winter
years.
If I remember the study, they were defining it by how much ice is on them.
Okay.
Yeah, yes. It was from the Journal of Environmental Research.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's just hard to put the ice on.
It's hard to put the ice on. So spring is starting sooner and fall is going longer.
Yeah. So interesting. Wasn't it 2014-15 we had our greatest ice extent? Or maybe it was after that. It wasn't that long ago.
No, it was. Yeah, 14.
And that 14. Coincided with the warmest year in the hemisphere's last 75 or so years. Yeah. So it's sometimes they're completely out of phase with each other.
Yeah.
Boy, it's interesting.
But this makes it all interesting, right?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. And it did show, I think the research was also pointing out that the Great Lakes have lost 25% of total ice cover between 1973 and 2023.
Yeah. And that doesn't, I mean, the amount surprises me, but the fact that the world is global, but this whole area is warming, you would expect to see more light.
Right,
less
and that's why for years on this show, we've been hearing that the Great Lakes levels is going down. I mean, you evaporate tons of water out of the lakes if you don't put ice on them in the wintertime.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the big factors.
Yeah.
Dave in Minocqua, give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the program. And I'm thinking about, wondering about controlling weather. And other than the little bit I've read about carbon capture or reducing carbon emissions, are there hopes or theories that have some possibility for future generations to in some ways manage not only climate change, but even influence weather favorably for farming and agriculture and things of that type?
Well, I'm not an expert, but I'll give you my opinion. My opinion is that the best we could ever hope for is to bend the trends in a direction that we'd rather have than what's going on. And I think that's especially true with the climate. If we can figure out some reasonable ways to capture carbon, if we can actually decide that we're going to try to figure out a different way to fuel our economies and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, not eliminate it, but reduce it, then we can bend the trend a little bit, perhaps, but it's still long timescales. But I have no confidence at all that we will be able to have substantial directed influence on weather, because the weather is just not going to stand that. This is too much. It's not a boundary value problem. It's an initial condition problem, and that effectively makes it impossible to fiddle with it, I think.
And it has a heck of a lot of energy.
It sure does. It sure does.
Changing things slowly, as we have been doing with carbon dioxide emissions, takes many, many, many years to change. And there's been a lot of work in the 60s and 70s, I think, and 50s to try and do weather modification. Mm. And it hasn't worked.
That's
it
right. It doesn't work. It does not work.
Which is good. Yeah. We probably would really screw it
up. We would screw it up. I think that's right. I mean, I think that's exactly right.
Right.
Somebody's interest would override somebody else's
interest, and you would take water away from somebody else.
Yeah, and you'd unleash a catastrophe.
Yeah.
Dave, thank you for calling. Dominique in Solon Springs. On to you now. Hi, Dominique.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm traveling to Great Britain for some road races in July. Is there a service in Great Britain that is similar to NOAA here?
Oh, yeah. The UK Met Office is one really good source for information over on the British Isles. And if not that, the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, the abbreviation ECMWF, is another place where they're centered in England. They're centered in England. And so they will also have a lot to say about conditions.
What was the first one again?
The United Kingdom Meteorological Office, known as the UK Met Office.
Oh, UK Met Office.
Yeah.
Okay. Dominique, there
you go.
That's
weather talk.
Yeah.
Weather talk. Okay. Dominique, thanks for calling. Brad in Fountain, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I was just kind of curious. I've noticed over last few years, like with NOAA's weather forecast, it seems like they're always trying to do an hourly update so you can never try and plan far enough ahead. And I'm looking at this more as for trying to do hay in the summertime. I remember 10, 15 years ago, I could look at a weekly forecast and kind of count on it. And now it seems like I got to check my phone every 60 minutes to see how they change. Because I can look and there'll be week's forecast with no rain, and I'll go out and cut hay, and I look that afternoon, and all of a sudden there's a 40% chance for the next morning. And I was wondering if it's just a new trend that they're trying to appease everybody that just wants this up-to-the-date information rather than actually picking a forecast that they can kind of stand behind, so to speak.
Hmm. First thing I would do is check the apps that you're using. It may be the apps that are doing it, not necessarily the National Weather Service, because I don't think they send out weekly updates, do they? Or hourly updates.
No, there is a forecast model that's initialized every, I think, 2 hours now, the high-resolution refresh.
Right. Yeah.
And so in the summertime, I think particularly they like to try and run that because it can give them a little bit more precision on severe weather, they think. And sometimes, well, I'd say, I shouldn't say it that way. I think it is accurate, that it's an improvement in the technology that's available that's sort of compelling the use of or more frequency in the updates. But I think there is occasionally a problem between the actual source of the information, as Steve's pointing out, and the app on the phone. That is definitely true. Yeah. We ran into that last week in Florida. It was nonsensical. And so luckily I have other places I like to look see. And sure enough, those were steady as a rock. So sometimes it's the app interface, I think.
So, and what's the best app in your mind for weather?
I don't use them. That's not what I go to. I go to forecast panels on somebody's website. So Tropical Tidbits is good.
I go to the NOAA websites typically. I do go to Weather Underground.
Yeah,
I do have their app.
One.
That's
mm-hmm.
that's a private one, and that works pretty well. Mm-hmm. That's been around for a long time, which is probably why they do so well.
Right, I bet that's it.
Yeah. Weather Underground. All right.
Yeah. So if you're carrying the phone around, you can get on the internet. I always use that instead of an app.
Brad, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Dennis in Blanchardville. On to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Just first a question, and that is that, well, I've been a farmer for 70 years, and I kind of agreed with Brad, the last caller, on how difficult it is they're becoming to make an accurate weather forecast because we're cutting hay and stuff. But the first question if we're increasing the amount of heat in the atmosphere, which we are, wouldn't that create more energy in the atmosphere and therefore create more wind in general? If you create more energy from more heat, I would think it would create more wind because that, after all, that's part of the reason why wind is wind.
Not necessarily. The wind is generated by pressure differences. If you have no pressure difference, it doesn't matter how much heat, how much you warm the atmosphere up, you're not going to generate a wind.
Yeah.
I would think, though, that between the elevation, and the temperature changes, which is what causes high pressure and low pressure, I would think that then with more heat, that would affect that. That's what I'm saying. According to my physics, what I studied many years ago, anytime you have more energy, you're going to have more of a reaction. And that's the reason I'm saying that more wind. And then the comment is this, that as a farmer, wouldn't this be true or wouldn't this be better to have it so that normally they give an average, rainfall per year? But what really is important is what the rainfall is during the growing season. So I think they should have another statistic that would be more accurate in order to show people what is going on during the growing season, as far as moisture goes.
That's an interesting point, your later one there, and then maybe John will have comments on your earlier point. But to look at the number of precipitations as a growing season and then doing the growing season will change whether or not you're looking at corn or wheat or whatever.
You get daily precipitation amounts at all first-order stations and a lot of second-order ones. And so we've commented on this in our newspaper article just for this last fall. So it's easy to get a monthly average precipitation. I'm sure that that's available to be quoted to just about anybody who wants it from the local Weather Service office. I wouldn't doubt that at all. It may not be the headlining thing that you hear about in the news media, but I bet you can get it easily. Because we had in October, we ended up with an average October for precipitation as a consequence of one day that was extraordinarily unusual. And so that's a great example of what you're talking about, how the distribution over the month was nothing close to normal, and anybody who lived here knew it. But we had one really exceptional day, averaged over the 31 days, that 3.5 inches of rain made it seem like a normal October. So it's absolutely right that that's more important, is the distribution. And about the energy, I think maybe you're thinking about all the energy is going to be spent in doing a job. The universe is exceptionally inefficient. There's energy all over the place that is incoherent and does nothing for anybody, including in our atmosphere. It's about 99% inefficient. So, you can warm the temperature, and as Steve says, there's all manner of things that have to happen in order for that to translate to an increase in wind speed, and it's unlikely that that would be the primary result, and it hasn't been recorded as such.
You know, I wonder if, there are services. I was interviewing a weather guy who had graduated from here at the UW and has his own, he has a team of five other people, meteorologists, and they do specific forecasts for various groups. One of the groups is farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was thinking that as John was talking there about, this could be a good app, rather than go to the National Weather Service, who are already overstressed in terms of doing forecasts, have it a private industry go and grab that data. All that data is available. It's in the newspaper every day.
That's right.
And then just summarize it in a nice, efficient, well, and easy-to-use app.
I think the cranberry farmers have done some of that already. They've kind of figured out how to put some observational sites on their bogs and various things, because it's really temperature sensitive and condition sensitive. And that's not in the purview of the National Weather Service. Yeah. That isn't their mandate.
Right.
And so there's room for private businesses to get in there and fill in the gap.
Yeah.
Machine learning or artificial intelligence, AI, is being used more to create weather forecasts, by the way. What do you think about AI as a tool for weather forecasting?
So two things I'll say, because I've been reading up on this after going to the AMS meeting. AI is being used in a variety of applications, and weather being one of them. Will it be good? I can see it in certain areas, like if you take radar imagery and you see a line of convection coming at you. I mean, right now, we fat finger that. When's it going to get us? Mm. There's where I think an AI application could do it, because their advantage is that they're really, really fast.
Yeah.
There's studies now where they're doing weekly forecasts. I think there are being claims that I think are being exaggerated. Yes, it is a lot faster, but they're based on current numerical weather prediction models. They need that data, and getting that data in an organized form is expensive, and it does take a lot of time. But once you get it, you can turn it on, and you make a forecast really, really quickly. That data also means that you have to have the extremity in it, and if your data set from the models is not accounting for climate change, then your AI models aren't going to be able to do it either. I will say, this final thing, my final thought on this, and that is, as we start to compare, because we're seeing this coming out in papers, an AI model being better than the ECMWF forecast model. And it's good to have those comparisons. We'll all learn from that. But the important thing to remember is the best forecaster is the meteorologist, human who gets at that data and looks and dissects that data. And I worry with regard to AI, which are not physically based models, unlike the ECMWF and the National Weather Services. As you begin to look at that and apply it to your local region, your city, the good meteorologist is going to look at that model and try and see what's going on physically. And you won't get that from the AI. And so I think the local forecast will go down.
And one of the consequences of what you just said, the lack of the physical basis for the forecast, is that this is really interesting. First, I'll say this broadly. I have great confidence that our community is approaching this possible revolution very intelligently.
Yeah.
With expert judgment, as you pointed out, too. We're trying to make sure that we don't make mistakes and just go whole hog into this thing without thinking about it. One of the aspects that community said is, you got to be able to see why the model is wrong. There has to be a way to account for the errors. And in AI, some of the AI models, there's absolutely no such accounting. And that leads experts to be very cautious about using them right now.
Yeah, some and that'll take models. The human out of it, and that's the expertise. We want that human brain in
you
there.
You have to have the expert judgment. Somehow.
On that happy note, we are out of time. And we're real. We're not artificial. And we know we've got to go. So our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, great to have them with us here today. And thank you so much for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.